Harbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Today we go back into the archives to celebrate the life and in memory of Jack Driscoll. Jack died this summer, the 25th of June, at age 78 in Mystic, Connecticut. He will be missed. Jack Driscoll and I spoke via phone in spring 2023. Thanks for listening today to this special episode in memoriam of Jack Driscoll.
It's a reckless wind that yearns to wander, and he was born the next of kin, the next of kin to the wayward wind.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Jack Driscoll is joining us via phone from Mystic, Connecticut. Jack, welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being game for some conversation about your latest collection of short stories, 20 stories. This out in 2022, published by Pushcart Press. I love the cover, Jack. To describe it for listeners, it's telling you what you're going to get: 20 stories by Jack Driscoll, new and selected.
Yeah, I actually had a title for it, but I was talked out of the title in favor of this, so I went with it. I deferred to better judgment, I guess. So, yeah. That's what it is, 20 stories, new and selected.
And why? What was the title? What were you going for?
The title was The New World Merging. It's a title of one of the stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought that had a certain ring, but...
one of the new stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've never not titled a book, and I'm not exactly sure, but I think maybe the marketing people were had a lot to, more than a little to do with this.
Well, I love it, Jack. That's why I was commenting on it. So, but
yeah.
But you know what? I also like the New World Merging, so maybe I'm an easy audience with that. But thanks again.
Good. We need that. D.
That's right. Well, I'm so glad to have this opportunity to talk with you about your fantastic short stories and about the form. And maybe if you want to talk a little bit about your poetry as well, the sky's the limit. Thanks for choosing the songs for today's program. Do you want to say anything about the leadoff song, Jack?
Well, it's an oldie, and it's a song. This is a cover, and I think I it'd be a wild guess if I tried to remember who sang it originally. When we're talking about songs, we're talking about music, and it's how I think about writing. I've always said that the impulse to write comes from the impulse to love. Story, character, and for me particularly, language. And I have no trouble thinking about words as notes and sentences as a unit where words happen that can either be cared about or not. And if I if there's no tunefulness to it, if I'm reading what I refer to as a deaf-eared prose, I've lost interest immediately. So yeah, music is a big part of my writing.
And when you're talking about the music within the prose, is this even present for you, Jack, when you're in the drafting stage, when you're generating ideas as a story is starting to come to you? Is it that intense early on, or is it something that is you're kind of returning to, like the line and the music mm-hmm. within the interconnected lines later on in revision.
Yeah, good question. The poet William Matthews says, revision isn't cleaning up after the party, revision is the party. And the truth is, if writers were known by their early drafts, literature as we know it would cease to exist. And process is process, and a friend of mine, writer by name of Mike Delp, claims me as the slowest writer in the history of the world.
That's what I was wondering.
Well,
how slow are you?
Hyperbole, his metaphor is Jack's the slowest writer I know. He moves at the pace of an ice age, and it's true. If I were to refer to him as a type, he would be a banger. He's one of those people who just, you know, he hits the keyboard as fast as he can, and then he looks back at what he has. But I don't move that way. My process is antithetical to that. I always say that process can't be prescriptive, because it can't. We'll all get to the end of our stories in the quirky ways we do. And no, I don't hear it all, as I'm inscribing, and clearly the revision process helps with that. But I won't move past the first sentence or the second sentence or wherever I am in the story unless I'm fairly happy with the sentence that precedes, because the sentence that I've just written makes possible what's going to happen next and the sentence after that, and that's the way I move. And I do, I think it was Robert Frost who advised writers to, or readers, to read with a listening ear, and I write with a listening ear. So, yeah, I mean, right out of the gate, I am looking for, since you brought up poetry, which was the first genre I started writing in, it's that lyric sense that that propels me forward. So yeah, I have to hear something. If it's clunking for me and I can hear it, I'm not ready to move on to that next sentence.
Yes, Jack. Before we get any further, because I was just going to ask you about three questions there after that, but. You know what? I'm going to read your bio so that we do this time-honored tradition before moving forward. Jack Driscoll is a 2-time NEA Creative Writing Fellowship recipient, a Penn Nelson Algren Award winner, and the author of 12 books, including the story collections Wanting Only to Be Heard, winner of the AWP Grace Paley Short Fiction Prize, and The World of a Few Minutes Ago, winner of the Society of Midland Authors Award and Michigan Notable Book Award. His most recent story collection, and now this one that we have with us, but his most recent story collection, The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot, received a Michigan Notable Book Award and was a finalist for the John D. Gardner Short Fiction Prize. His stories have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Southern Review, Plowshares, Missouri Review, Michigan Quarterly Review, the Pushcart Prize, Anthology, that's key, and New Stories from the Midwest. Driscoll was the founding father of the Interlochen Center for the Arts Creative Writing Department and teaches in Pacific University's Low Residency MFA program. He resides in Mystic, Connecticut, where he joins us via phone. Hey, are you, because I think you were, just a couple months ago, you were in Seattle, at PU for the MFA program. Is that right, Jack?
I was in Oregon. I was in a little town called Seaside on the Oregon coast.
Oh, is that where Pacific University's low residency MFA program is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, there are two different sites. Neither is in Seattle, but one is on campus, which is in Forest Grove, Oregon, and then the winter residency, the one I like better because of the beaches and the mountains, is in Seaside, Oregon.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. I've had a chance to drive along the coast there, and it's really something.
Mm-hmm.
And good. Mm-hmm. good cheese too, right?
Yes, that's right.
And probably good fishing, because fishing is a big part of what I feel like I know about you, Jack, from some photographs. And yeah, is that how is fishing like like writing for you?
I don't know that it is like writing, except it's quiet. When I'm on the river, I'm not talking. I'm usually fishing alone. Even if I've gone fishing with somebody, we're not standing shoulder to shoulder. You know, we're moving up and down the river. And writing is a passion, of course, and the definition of passion is to suffer, and we only suffer this passion in about 1,000 different ways. And from one of the photographs, I'm thinking, although I'm not sure, that my good friend, a longtime great friend, Pete Fromm, sent you, of a giant ant fly stuck in my face.
Yes.
So yeah, I'd be there. We suffer that passion too, but it truly is one of the things I love most in the world. I love doing most in the world.
It's fly fishing.
Fly fishing, writing
and writing
fishing.
And yeah. Right. Because it's like, yeah, it's not the Living Fly Fishing Show, so I'm gonna just like double check with you. Although that could be, I mean, that's an idea waiting to happen, right? So that could be a new podcast, or there's one out there, I'm sure. I'm sure, but
yeah, I could demonstrate how to power cast into the wind so that the hook comes back and gets me right in the cheek.
I'll put that one on the Instagram so everyone can see it. I mean, you're smiling in the photo too, so it's kind of...
Yeah, well, it was a little after the fact. You know, we were on our way to see if we could get... Well, we were on our way to the hospital to see if we could get it taken out. And I won't... it would take too long to tell me the story about how it happened without any medical attention.
Right. Well, anyway, it connects to the first, actually, the lead story that you have in 20 Stories by from Wanting Only to Be Heard. Not fly fishing, but ice fishing, which seems like maybe something that you were doing in Michigan while you were living the years you lived here.
It certainly is not fly fishing. The artistry of fly fishing is like... it's not unlike the discipline of writing. It takes a long time to be able to finesse something like that. And as you can see in the photograph, I hadn't entirely finessed that cast. But ice fishing is a wholly other world and a different culture. I'm thinking people who fly fish probably don't ice fish all the time.
Okay.
I don't, but friends of mine, local fellows, would invite me out to their shanties, and so I have experienced that, and it's sort of fun just sitting out there. There's a heater in the shanty because it's awfully cold, and you know, it's a kind of camaraderie that sets in, and you know, you start talking and whatnot, and I love just, you know, hanging out with these guys, and they would invite me, so I'd go. And I mean, you know, it defines really where I've been living for almost half a century. If you like to ice fish, good for you, because you're going to have a long time to do it. We have a number of standing jokes, such as July and August. Oh yeah, 2 months of lousy sledding. That's one. Or we have 3 seasons in northern Michigan: July, August, and winter. So, yeah, it's a culture that sort of loves to go out and drink some beer, and sometimes they even are decorated up with furniture so you can get comfortable out there. You know, a couch, and you stare into a hole, and you know, wait for this little rubber band bobber to go down. And you pull up a smelt, if that happens to be what you're fishing for, ice fishing for, which is mostly what I did.
And it feels like the world then that you're creating for the story, wanting only to be heard, is very like a young male world. There are older men that are kind of around the edges of the story, but there's an intensity to the place and an ominous quality that is in the story that's not really in the telling of ice fishing itself, obviously. But it occurred to you to have this, like, something that feels very, gosh, you can't say it's a rite of passage because there's nothing on the other side for one of the characters in the story, but it feels like a very young man experience. And idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this is it's a bad case of wintertime, and I've always said that the most fatiguing enterprise I've ever experienced is boredom. And in a climate like this, and especially for kids, it's a kind of inertia, and they're bored silly, and so they take dramatic action against it. And in this story, of course, it ends tragically. It ends with a drowning. When the kids decide that they can pull a Houdini stunt, and as Houdini took his dive under the Detroit River, claiming he was following the voice of his dead mother, and then finally came up and he survived it, and so they do their homework and they think, okay, we can do this too. Maybe we can even become legendary. We're going to get some attention for this when we pull it off. And they talk themselves into believing that they can. And that's when it all goes badly. But it's the climate itself that creates that story, and which is why I believe that, you know, that places everything. Jose Ortega y Gasset says, "Tell me the place in which you live, and I will tell you who you are." Place forms character, and this is what these kids are suffering and taking measures against it.
Jack, let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to hear more, and we'll pick up here with this story. Great. We won't move away from it. Today on Living Writers, Jack Driscoll joins us via phone from Mystic, Connecticut. The book on the table, 20 Stories, New and Selected. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Frank behind the glass. We'll be back.
You got me singing. Even though the news is bad, you got me singing the only song I ever had. You got me singing ever since the river died. You got me thinking of the places we could hide. You got me singing. Even though the world is gone, you got me thinking, and I'd like to carry on. You got me singing.
Even though. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Jack Driscoll is here via phone, joining us from Mystic, Connecticut. Jack, thanks again for picking the songs for today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So this last one it feels like it's creating place. It's unfolding within the music and atmosphere of that song, doesn't it? or does it for you? I guess I should
no,
say.
Yeah, no, it does. No, it does. And I absolutely love Leonard Cohen, and I love that song.
He's such a storyteller.
Yeah, yeah. I've been following Leonard Cohen's work since the first time I heard, I can't remember what song it was, but I thought, oh, my God.
Well, and when you said it's one of your favorite songs, Jack.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Why?
Well, just the intensity of the song. I think you mentioned, excuse me, place in connection with the song.
Yes.
What were you thinking?
What I was thinking is more of the atmosphere that it feels like when you're coming into the layers of the instruments and then his voice, there's like a depth there and this feeling that feels like it matches quite well with sort of our conversation so far. What about you? But why is it your favorite or one of your favorites?
Yeah. Well, I felt like a disc jockey when he asked me to do this, to put them together. And I'd actually have to look at the lyrics. It's been, you know, I said, okay, I need a Leonard Cohen song. Which one? And I just went with it. But yeah, it's the delivery as much as the lyrics for me. That his voice for one, but the intensity of the language, and there's a writer by the name of David Roderick. He's not talking about music per se, but he is talking about language, and he says it's not the tale that pleases; it's the telling. In other words, I'm stirred by what T.S. Eliot calls the auditory imagination. In other words, the ability to hear makes possible a clarity for the eye. I think the eye reports to the brain, but the ear reports to the heart. And I think that's the thing that musicians can do that that writers maybe can't ever quite. And then, you know, I read songs, or I read stories, particularly stories more so than novels, whereby I think, okay, maybe that is just what, that's exactly what just happened, or at least it happened to me as a reader.
Yes, definitely. Well, I love that you said auditory imagination. That is wonderful. And the intensity present in the song, it makes me think of the intensity present in the short story form. Why is this a form that you've been drawn to, Jack?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm going to circle back. I started writing poems. When I started writing poems, and I did that without ever trying prose for probably 30 years, something like that, and Interlochen gave me a sabbatical, and I promised myself if I completed a manuscript of poetry, of poems I was working on, I would try fiction for the first time ever, and I did have the time, and I did start writing short fiction.
And did you love it? What did it allow, like, how was it a different, like, what did it allow you to do as a writer or to try that wasn't part of the finishing the poetry manuscript?
But what I find I can do in a short story is unsustainable on novel length. I've written four novels as well. And, I mean, if you read, like, Hopkins' The Wreck of the Deutschland, for example, you have that the feeling that if he had gone on any longer with that, you know, would have burned out like a comet or something. And writers who come to mind who have found a place for poetry in the prose, and it's what I try to do. I'm always looking for poetry's place in the prose. And writers who come to mind, some, by the way, who have never written novels, for example, Lee K. Abbott, Stuart Dybeck. Those two, I'm pretty sure. Other writers who, other fictionists, prosers, who write both novels and short stories, whose work I really love because it is so, the intrigue of the language itself is present for me, and one writer comes to mind is the Australian writer Kate Kennedy, Elizabeth McCracken, Anthony Doerr, James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and particularly Joan Didion, who Frank Bruni in the New York Times Book Review wrote a really interesting essay about, claiming that it might have been the result of a short attention span, but what he was really saying is that sometimes he likes individual sentences, as do I, more than entire books. And when I read those, and I'm not necessarily reading aloud, I'm lifting the sentences from the page with my eye, but I'm hearing it, I'm listening. And these are the writers who whose work I tend to like best. In other words, even a good plot can't compensate for me a language that, like I already referenced, as tin-eared.
Yes.
A language without any resonance, it just won't do it for me.
I know what you mean, Jack, about having these moments with books. Like, for example, when I was listening to you talk about these writers and their work, like, that has meant a lot to you, like they're like your writing family in some ways, it sounds like. I think of Toni Morrison and her novel Beloved. I can remember reading it as such like a young person just graduated from university, and it's graduation time here on campus, so maybe that's why. And just having to write down, wanting to write down so many of her lines. And I was working in, at one point, a very dull, cubicle job in LA, and I just... luckily, I did have some time where I could kind of read if the phone wasn't ringing until they realized they could give me more to do. But I had just the whole place, Jack, with these quotes from Beloved. Just the singing of the words, the power in the words.
Exactly.
So let's talk about like this intensity that's in your short stories. And that, because a short story, it's I love how you're talking about the lyric qualities within the lines, but often it's also like wound tight. It's like they're intense experiences. Yeah. It's hard to like keep reading short stories. You have to kind of, I think, take a break before you enter another world of a short story. And that's certainly the case with your 20 stories, Jack. Is there a part of one that you would read to us so we, like, everyone gets a chance to hear some of the prose read by you?
Yeah, for sure. And yes, I agree with you about the what I call the white light or white fire of the short story, and that's what I meant when I said earlier that kind of intensity is unsustainable novel length. I simply don't think it can be sustained that way. And if I don't forget to say it, there are a few other things that the short story does, or at least for me, that also I don't feel is possible in the novel. They're really two very different mediums. I'll read just a couple of paragraphs, just the opening of a story I haven't yet read. It's a new, one of the new stories.
Oh, great!
And I was thinking I might read it in June when I head out to Oregon again for the summer residency. It's called Gracie and DeVere, and it's a story I was happy to have written because I'm always looking to break through to that next place where I haven't yet arrived. Otherwise, it's just too easy to start sounding like yourself, a kind of self-imitation, and that's the one thing I don't want to do. And The reason I was happy with this story is because it actually has multiple points of view. I think there are 4 points of view in here. But here's the opening. It's called Gracie and Devere. The twins' combined age is 20, 2 years older than their mom when she had them, born healthy on New Year's, a few minutes after midnight. Small-town celebrity babies. They'll strike the birth father, sticking around for the local newspaper photographers and ducking out instead into the hospital parking lot for a cigarette and some cold air to clear his head. Excuse me for just a minute. I'm going to put my glasses on. I'm pretty much doing this from memory.
Oh, geez,
okay.
No.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Except for the bell-shaped birthmark high up on Devere's left thigh, the girls are identical, their wobbly, bow-legged first steps having occurred almost simultaneously. Ditto their discernible first spoken words, bye-bye, and how they wave to him. They're about to be absentee daddy who, on that morning, did not, as he'd promised, go outside only long enough to install his daughter's safety seats in the decade-old, high-mileage family Ford Falcon. He backed it slowly out of the driveway instead and cranked up the radio and hightailed it for parts unknown. Currently, the safety seats hang side by side from the garage rafters like tiny abandoned swings. And seemingly out of nowhere and absent any encouragement from anyone, the twins have long since ceased straddling the heat register after taking their baths. Big girls now, who used to laugh and Lindy like showgirls as their nightgowns filled and lifted.
Thank you, Jack.
That's the opening section of the story.
Yeah, and was that, where did you write that one out in Oregon at the residency that you're looking forward to returning to? Or how did this story start for you?
Well, I am a twin.
For one,
an identical twin, and I'm sure some of that factored in. When I get started on a story, I mean, it may sound as if because I'm a twin, I wrote the story. That just happened to be. I really have no idea. I never sit down and think, okay, I'm going to write a story about this. I'm going to write a story about twins. I always believed when I was writing poems, if I could get a line that interested me, I could get that poem without having any idea where that poem was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And this holds true for fiction as well. I am so comfortable. I am most comfortable and so comfortable in the presence of not knowing.
Yes.
And discovering what it is I have to say when I begin to inscribe. It's what Stephen Dunn refers to as those unconscious informing elements. And so I really have no idea where any of this is headed. So I don't know really where it came, except I came up with the first sentence, the twins' combined age is 20. And I thought, okay, where do we go from here? And the story came together.
That's what I was going to ask you. Was the first sentence literally what we got to hear that came to you? It becomes mm-hmm. the first. Is that sort of your process too for some of the other stories in 20 stories? Is the first sentence what comes to you, and then the rest follows? Like you were explaining to us earlier, almost like the first and then the next. It's very important that each is building on the
mm-hmm.
other.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is like a machete whacking through the tangle of language for direction into the light, and that's what I do. I mean, you know, I whack and whack and open it up a little bit, and the trail goes forward very slowly. And if I'm lucky, it leads me to the light, and that's how I get to the end of the stories. That's the entire process, and I follow hunches, I follow intimations, and I worry a lot. That's pretty much how I do it.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back to talk mm-hmm. about some of the worry today on Living okay. Writers. Jack Driscoll mm-hmm. joins us via phone from Mystic, Connecticut. The book on the table with us, 20 Stories, New and Selected. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
As I'm being followed by a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow, leaping and hopping on a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow. And if I ever lose my hands, lose my plow, lose my land, oh, if I ever lose my hands, oh, I won't have to work no more. And if I ever lose my eyes, if my colors all run dry, yes, if I ever lose my eyes, oh, I won't have to cry no more. Yes, I'm being followed by a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Jack Driscoll is on the line with us. The book on the table, 20 Stories by Jack Driscoll, New and Selected, with Pushcart Press. before we were taping Jack, you were joking about possibly singing along to the songs. And I want you to know, had we been here in person, you would have seen that I started singing along, and then I was like, "Ooh, I better move away from the mic just in case it's still live."
I wish I'd been there with you. We would have done it.
Yeah, I know. Were you singing along in Mystic?
Oh yeah, I'm always singing along.
Well, before the break, Jack, we were talking about your new stories and how you are, you know, as part of your writer's creed, I guess, or so, is mm-hmm. like you're looking like you're always looking for that first line, but then also something new, like the multiple perspectives. And what are some other things that you were discovering in these new stories that are still you? Like, they've still got the mm-hmm. Jack Driscoll stamp on them, mm-hmm. thankfully.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. It's a good one. I mean, clearly a writer's work evolves over a career, over a lifetime. And when I was putting the stories together, that was pretty much what I wanted to do, to provide an arc. And yes, you're right, T. It's my voice. And I think of voice as a fingerprint. It's unmistakable.
Yes.
And so the work is mine, and you'll see that. But these are some of the changes, as you asked the question. My first response is this, that in the early stories, the first story collection, Wanting Only to Be Heard, the thematic development throughout, and not that I was conscious of doing this. I mentioned earlier that I don't sit down to say I'm going to write a story about this. I sit down and I start writing. But I found out what the thematic development of that book was by reading reviews of it. I had no idea. I had no idea what the themes were. And it turned out to be the relationship between fathers and sons, not necessarily the relationship between me and my father, but fathers and sons. And I am Irish, and James Joyce promised us Irish lads that at some point we would come to reconcile with our fathers. But I never did. I've told this story before. My dad worked 364 days a year, 16 hours a day. Do the math and you think impossible, but in fact that's what he did. And the reason being that he believed that given that we were the first, my generation was the first generation that was expected to go to college, and he believed that he could leverage a better place in the world for his children if he could provide for them, which he did. And there were five of us which he sent to college.
Wow.
But the downside of this, and by the way, this can only announce itself in one word only, and that's love, a total renunciation, nothing for himself, everything for his children. The downside, and I loved him for that. I do love him for that. And I also love him for having taught me how important a blue-collar, a determined blue-collar, a fanatical blue-collar work ethic is.
Yes.
to the creation of art. I always say talent is talent, and it's probably divvied out unequally. But talent means nothing until it discovers its equivalent in a hardcore work ethic. And that's the thing I learned from my father. The downside, of course, was I didn't know him. I never knew him.
Mm-hmm.
He was gone before we awoke, and he came back after we had gone to bed. And so and there were things, of course, in my imagination was animated by the things I wanted to do with my father and never did. So that was and I don't know, maybe a writer goes through an entire career with writing to one obsession or
mm-hmm.
two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, that's just that's circumspect. But in these new stories, and I have heard from people who have said kind things about them, and thematically, since I'm talking about that, the thematic design, though again, I wasn't conscious of this now, and perhaps because I'm getting older, is the nature of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as the writer Jim Harrison says, time rushes towards me. It has no brakes. And I understand that. And in the new stories, people have been writing. I just got a beautiful letter just a couple of days ago, saying that they're more tender. There's a tenderness about them that wasn't nearly as present or prevalent in the earlier work. So I was glad to hear that. So those are some of the differences, some of the evolution that I'm conscious of having occurred already.
And so Jack, when you hear that, is it something where you feel like you can then recognize it from hearing someone, a reader's perspective, saying there is more tenderness? You feel it mm-hmm. to be true too, then you can have that window into it.
Yeah, it's why I was so pleased to hear it from a number of people. And I know they had gotten together because I don't think they know one another.
Right.
But I don't know that it's easy for a reader to, sort of come forward and claim this. I wish I had that letter I'm referencing now, because I would read a paragraph to you. No, it made me feel great. I thought, okay, you know, good for me, good for you, Jackie boy. you're getting softer in your old age. How about them apples? You know,
more, maybe just adding more dimensions. Although, as soon as you said that, I wanted to say, but I feel like there's like tenderness in, for example, the story that we, you know, wanting only to be heard, that we started mm-hmm. talking about at the beginning of the hour,
mm-hmm.
between the father and son, not really among the friends, like that feels more of like a competition or so.
Mm-hmm.
But with the father and
right.
and how the son knows he will protect mm-hmm. him, even though there's not much that's said, but there's like there's a physicality to it, which mm-hmm. is present as,
yeah
I won't keep trying to make connections across the space of the book.
And thank you for saying that too, for making that observation, because that was one of the things I wanted to make clear. And again, this is after the fact, after reading it, I'm thinking, okay, does the love between the father and the son, the love for the father shows to the son there, and it is. I know it is.
Yes, yes. And that's a hardworking father in that story as well.
Yeah, and most of my characters are. You know, there many of them are sort of, they what I call dare to hope characters against sometimes seemingly impossible odds. They do nonetheless.
Prowlers, for example.
yeah, exactly, yeah. And I hope there's a sense of humor. Wanting only to be heard is a tough story. It's all my stories are love stories. I can't believe that I've ever written one that isn't. Mm-hmm. I sense that humor is a natural relaxant. It allows the reader to step more easily into the fray. And yeah, Prowlers is a it's a dramatic story too. And but I hope it's ameliorated some by a sense of humor in the story as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, those are very likable characters that we get to meet and to imagine on horseback. And so let's return to Michigan, because this is a place, a state where you lived a big chunk of time, and you were, and a lot of the time was dedicated to the Interlochen writing program, I would imagine, mm-hmm. if you're the founder.
Mm-hmm.
What's it been like for you with being the founder and teaching writing to young people for those years?
Yeah, for those years I taught. I arrived when I was still in my 20s. I was still a kid. I knew pretty much nothing. One of the great quandaries in my life, and this is not hyperbolic, is why they hired me. It still makes no sense to me at all. I knew almost nothing, and I had one. A slim book out, but they did fly me out for an interview and apparently liked me. And so I stayed for all that time. I learned to teach. This is Interlochen, for people who don't know. It is a coeducational boarding school for the arts. And it's represented by 60, 65 different countries. So you can imagine the kinds of conversations to have people from everywhere, from countries all around the world, assembled in common interest to talk about this thing the rest of the world could care less about, much of the rest of the world could care less about. It made for just wonderful. I learned so much from my students. The musicians taught me how to listen better, the painters how to see better. Etc. And so I can say unequivocally that it stands as the single greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. It's made everything else possible. And what I can say now, having taught long enough, is that, well, I think it's Borges who said, I'm prouder of the books I've read than the I'm prouder of the books I've read than the books I've written, and I amend it this way: I'm prouder of the books my students have written than the books I've written. And nothing buoys my spirits more than to get a book in the mail from one of my students, or even better, to provide a jacket blurb for my students. And my wife and I are bibliophiles, and we have a private library, or did until I moved here, of about 7,000 or 8,000 books. And I have, and two of those shelves now include books only by my students. You can only get onto those shelves if you're one of my students. And some of my students even send postcards and say, "Here, put this in. Save me. So, in other words,
save me a spot. Yeah.
Save me a spot. And how beautiful. Oftentimes they come through, and I can fill that spot with the books. And it's in all genres: poetry collections, short story collections, novels, memoirs, you name it.
Wow, that's wonderful, so Jack. Yeah.
Yeah, I have never. I have been interviewed quite a bit, and one of the questions assumes, or one of the attitudes assumes, at least by the nature of the question, that these two are in some way oppositional. In other words, teaching must take up way too much of your writing life. For me, they're inextricable. They're just two parts of the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. It's why I stayed. I really thought this was. Wasn't the Midwest that territory you flew over on your way to one of the dream coasts? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, or drove through at night. I mean, who would actually put down there? And I don't know. Maybe I was carrying some of that bias with me, I thought it was a stopover on my way elsewhere, probably back to the East Coast, where it turns out I am now, but not for half a century. I absolutely fell in love with the place. It's where I wanted to be.
Yeah, it gets to you if you're not from here. I can understand, because I also am not from here, but it definitely, I feel fiercely proud of Michigan now as well.
Where are you from?
50, well, I grew up in Florida. Good luck, Florida.
So you're a transplant.
Yeah. But the West Coast, though, so that's why I could daydream about your Oregon coast. But Jack, can we talk a little bit more about then how the setting of Michigan has it's informed the lives of your characters. Like, I can see how some of the characters, like when we've talked about your father and kind of where you're coming from and the work ethic and the and in the stories, the setting here, Michigan is present. It's palpable. Not to mention your awards, you know, the Michigan, you know, like many Michigan awards too. Mm-hmm. So the landscape is here, and you chose to stay.
It's I did.
So it's your imaginative landscape now too, Jack, or?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, time will tell how that's going to affect the writing now, having moved away. And yeah, I've been here for 6 months, and the reason I'm here is because I'm close to my family. And but the level of disorientation is still intense. It's not that I'm thinking about moving back, though it wouldn't surprise me if that were to happen. But yes, as I said earlier, place is character. And there's a writer by the name of Michael O'Rourke who points out that there was a time when place and person were exactly the same thing. Jesus of Nazareth, Sappho of Lesbos, middle namesake, St. Francis of Assisi, the 15th century contemplative St. Teresa of Avila, Robin of Nottingham, I mean, on and on. There was no difference between the two. Place informs everything. I would even argue that place is character. And to try and set my stories elsewhere, which would be inane, but to try and do that would mean that the stories ceased to be. They couldn't exist anywhere else. There's only one story that's set elsewhere, and that's in Maine, but those are Northern Michigan characters who go to Maine one summer for a vacation. So yeah, everything is informed by that particular landscape. And I was talking earlier about the severity of the and the malady of chronic inertia that sets in when you are locked into a place like that, whereby, and it's northern and it's rural and it's intense. So yes, it take that away, my stories don't exist.
Because you also had to learn it and feel it as the writer you were becoming.
Mm-hmm. I did, and I had no real expectations, given that I thought this was, as I said, a stopover. But then I loved it. I was born in Western Massachusetts, and I was thinking, Detroit. Southern. I was thinking Southern Michigan and industrial and flatlands, and Interlaken is about 5-6 hours north of there. So it's another country, and it wasn't so unlike Western Massachusetts. So it was very beautiful. Net number one, I found it to be very beautiful with lots of waterways.
Yes.
And I met a lot of the local folk there, who were happy to lead me in, and in fact, wanting only to be heard is dedicated to my father, but also to a fellow named Noel Schroeder, who was a local kid and worked at his father's Shell station, and he showed me in, and you know, there's a certain wisdom and native intelligence that is associated with people who actually grown up there, and that seemed miraculous to me. So I really did fall in love with every facet of it, and I still love it as much. And I'll be going back there in, I think it's at the end of July, for a kind of celebration reading.
Oh, that's wonderful, Jack.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to it.
So returning to Interlaken for a celebration reading. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. I think it was Tom Wolfe who said, you leave, you can never go home again. But I like better what Bob Dylan said. You can always come back, but you can't come back all the way. And I like that idea. Yeah, you can come back, and maybe you're changed by your those interludes of absence, but you can come back nonetheless. So that's what I'm doing. I'm thinking of it as a kind of homecoming.
I'm so glad. I'm so very glad, Jack. Thank you so much for talking with me today. About your 20 stories, new and selected, with Pushcart Press. I'm glad that we were kind of ending on Michigan.
we were full circle.
A love letter to Michigan in a way.
And
you know what? And then we'll see, right? Because you said just a couple minutes ago, we'll see what happens with the stories, the poems, are you working on a novel now? What's happening now for you with writing?
Okay, I'm going to give it away here to you, all right? I said, I like to break through to that next place where I haven't yet arrived. I've written 4 collections of poems, 4 collections of short stories, 4 novels. And so the next project, which I've just started, is a memoir.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, Jack Driscoll, we will stay tuned.
All right. T, thanks so much for your great conversation, your great questions, and your close read of my work. It matters enormously.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jack. Thank you for the time and for writing these stories. We really loved our talk today. Today on Living Writers, Jack Driscoll joined us via phone from Mystic, Connecticut. He'll be returning in July to Interlaken, a homecoming. The book on the table with us, 20 Stories by Jack Driscoll, new and selected, out with Pushcart Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We've had Frank behind the glass for this one. Thank you, Frank. Thanks, everyone out there, for listening. Until next time.
Take them away, take them away, Lord. Take away these chains from me. My heart is broken because my spirit's not free. Lord, take away these chains from me. Some birds' feathers are too bright to be caged. I know I'm not that colorful, but a bird just the same. Open up your gate now, let me put down my load, so I can feel at ease and go back to my home. Take them away, Lord. Take away these chains from me. My heart is broken cause my spirit's not free. Lord, take away these chains from me. Sun beating down, my legs can't seem to stand. There's
WCBN FM Ann Arbor Archives. Original air date November 13, 2016 at 9 a.m.
Public service announcement from WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Don't do drugs. Also, stay in school. Read a lot of books.
Wear your seatbelt.
Eat broccoli. Consider joining an orchestra.
Keep your shoes tied.
Perhaps you'd like to go for Velcro.
Cut your hair regularly.
Always clean behind your ears.
Always clean your crack.
All of your cracks. But certainly never do crack.
Remember to breathe.
And breathe very, very deeply.
Pick your nose with Kleenex, not with your finger.
Try meditating. It's good for reducing stress and lowering your blood.